Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. Well, happy Valentine's Day, everyone. And I thought we'd start out with a little essay by Richard Roper from the Sun-Times. Sexism, injustice, pain. It's all in the Valentine monologues. Richard writes, who's responsible for Valentine's Day becoming a major commercial and romantic event, featuring cards and flowers and dinner reservations and the giving of the bling? Who's behind the dubious trend of some houses and businesses actually displaying elaborate Valentine's Day decorations in their windows and on their doors for weeks before the big day? Who's the driving force behind Valentine's Day as a marketing phenomenon, a huge date night for restaurants and theaters, an advertising gimmick, a near-official American holiday? Nope. We can't blame it on the greeting card companies or the chocolate manufacturers or the jewelers or even those mysterious people in Vermont who have been devoting their lives to making cutesy-themed teddy bears. Sure. The romantic product industries have a vested interest in Valentine's Day, and they've aggressively contributed to its frightening growth, but it's not the corporate America people that should be held responsible for making Valentine's Day a holiday. It's women. Without women, Valentine's Day would die a quick death. Without the input of women, February 14th would be just another cold day. A generalization? You betcha. But it's an accurate one. I wish we could test it right now. I wish we could ask the men of this country just one question. Should Valentine's Day exist? What do you think the results would be? How many men would actually vote to keep Valentine's Day on the calendar? Zero. Not even that guy on Will and Grace. Valentine's Day exists because women want it to exist. We can talk all we want about men and women being equal and wanting the same things, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is that most women are thrilled about the existence of Valentine's Day. And most, if not all, men would rather catch a head cold than observe the rituals of Valentine's Day. Of course, you could take a stand. You could tell your honey that you don't believe in Valentine's Day and you're not going to be co-opted by a commercialized holiday. If you want to demonstrate your love, you don't need Hallmark to do your talking for you. You're a rebel, an individualist, a man's man. You're not going to send flowers or take her out to dinner or buy her treats just because the advertising agencies and the fluffy articles in the newspapers say you should. One might think a woman would appreciate a man who thinks for himself like that. And one would be wrong. The man who tells a woman he doesn't celebrate or believe in Valentine's Day is not rewarded or applauded. He is branded as a terminal cheapskate and a thoughtless oaf. Even if the woman in his life smiles sweetly and says, "That's all right, honey, I don't care about Valentine's Day." Inside, she is thinking, "You stupid jerk. How am I supposed to go to work and act happy when all the women around me are getting flowers and sappy phone calls? You stupid jerk." The only way this Valentine's Day madness could be reined in would be if millions of women of all ages decided to put a stop to it. If women led the movement to simplify and scale back Valentine's Day to make it less of an event, well, only they have that power. Men, imagine if the woman in your life came to you this morning and said, "Honey, please don't plan anything special for Valentine's Day this year. In fact, I insist that we don't do anything. If you want to take me to dinner or send me flowers or tell me how much you love me, do it when you sincerely want to do it, not when the calendar says you're supposed to do so. That's not love. That's cultural peer pressure. Until the woman lets the man off the hook for Valentine's Day, the man is on the hook for Valentine's Day. It's just their holiday, and we're just slaves to it. Richard Roper, sexism, injustice, pain, it's all in the Valentine monologues. Now, sometimes we have to endure some pain, but happy Valentine's Day to everybody out there. Let's play a little music from Henry Mancini from the movie 10. It's easy to say, and we'll be back on The Kevin Moore Show. Henry Mancini, It's Easy to Say, from the movie 10. We're back on the Kevin Moore Show celebrating Valentine's Day. The history of cheese fondue dates back to the sheep and goat herders of the 1500s. While moving their flocks across the mountains, valleys of Switzerland, they would carry cheese, bread, and wine. Over time, the shepherds learned to melt the cheese into the wine and dipped their breads into the cheese, hence creating cheese fondue. Geha's 9-day Valentine's Festival. Chicago's most romantic restaurant sets hearts on fire with sweet specials everyone will love, plus a special evening dedicated to celebrating marriage. Be mine, Valentine. Gaius Cafe, the renowned restaurant of romance located at 340 West Armitage, is planning the most romantic Valentine's celebration in its 55-year history. From Sunday, February 9th through Monday, February 17th, Gaius Cafe will be elegantly decorated for the love-filled holiday and will feature a selection of rosé sparkling wines and champagnes, delicious fondue cuisine, perfectly complemented with entertainment throughout the evening from live flamenco and classical guitarists. The Valentine's Festival will also play host to the ever-popular Celebration of Marriage Night, where couples receive an added discount based on the years they've been married. Our goal at Gaius Cafe is to create the perfect Valentine's experience for our guests that spans past the actual day, says Jeff Lawler, Gaius' owner. We will combine the necessary ingredients of an intimate atmosphere, fine champagnes, lavish decorations, live music, flower arrangements by Dilly Lily, couple massage packages and massage house, and delicious fondues into the perfect recipe for romance. And no one better to tell us about that, what's in store for us, than Gaius Cafe, than the second most romantic man in Chicago, the award-winning leader in the hospitality industry, one of Chicago's great restaurateurs, and the owner and general manager of Chicago's most romantic dining destination, now presenting in his Restaurant of Romance Valentine's Day at Gaius Cafe, 340 West Armitage, for 9 days, beginning February 9th through February 17th. Our good pal, Mr. Jeff Lawler. How you doing, my pal?
Happy Valentine's 2020. Kevin, thank you for our time together again.
Our tradition continues. You know, we were both in high school when this started, and we started talking.
It feels like it, yes.
And here we are so many years later. You're still doing what you do as well as anybody in the industry, and I'm getting older.
Oh, so am I. And matter of fact, I just looked up your picture. I mean, you're quite a dashing man. I mean, so.
Well, whoever's listening, please look up my picture, according to Jeff, please. Thank you for that compliment. But nothing more dashing than spending Valentine's Day at Gaius. And, you know, Jeff, all seriousness aside here, we've been talking about this for so long, but each year is bigger and better than the last. And, you know, one thing, and I know we're going to get to this, but I'm going to laugh at this. The special celebration of marriage night, when we started, I think it was 2 or 3% off the bill. Now it's 1% because so many people who've been married 50 or 60 years come back and you have to pay them.
Yes. That was the case. For many years, probably for about 10 years, we were doing 2% off the food bill, for every year you were married. And if you hit the 50-year mark, then we were taking care of your cocktails also, okay? because you deserve it after 50 years. I was blown away by how many couples had been married 50-plus years. There was one year I remember we added up all the years of marriage sitting down in Gaius at one particular moment, and it was over 1,200 years of marriage.
But it's funny.
And never having been married before, and as you may remember, I got married in 2008.
Right.
This gives me great hope and belief that marriage can last.
Yes, that's true.
After many years, you get some fondue at Gaius.
And for no other reason than to do that.
Right, that's right. Exactly. Do it for the fondue.
And what's so much fun is it's not 1 or 2 days. You know, it's just not Valentine's Day, day before Valentine's Day, after. You celebrate for 9 days. That's a long time. But it gives everybody a chance. Because schedules being as what they are and people being busy, they still don't have an excuse not to come to Gaius and enjoy your hospitality.
It is a Valentine's festival. That's why we do it for 8 or 9 days, depending on the way the Valentine's fall. This year, falling on a Friday, we had the seatings of 3 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5:30, 6:30, 8 o'clock, and 9 o'clock. Well, the 4 o'clock through 9 o'clock sold out so quickly, we added 10 o'clock and 10:30.
Really?
Yeah. So, and we added more seatings. We still have tables available at, of course, the 3 o'clock and the 10:30 on Saturday, and I may even on Valentine's too. And then Sunday, same situation. We just love celebrating Valentine's at Geha's, and so do guests that have been coming here for 30 and 40 years.
But that's a beautiful, that's a brilliant marketing idea to have a 10 or 10:30, because fondue that late in the evening, that's a natural.
It is. I mean, back in the day when I first started here, Geha's hours, we closed at midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many times on a Saturday night I would be on a wait for a table at midnight.
Really?
And
really?
people expected it, and they came back at 11:30 for their table, and they would sit down, and they would enjoy their dinner, their experience, until 2 to 2:30 in the morning. And they don't do that now. I mean, we're open until 11 o'clock because times have changed.
Sure.
And people just don't eat late like they used to. Mm-hmm. But there was a time we'd be on a wait very late at night. So, yeah, starting the dinner at 10:30, where you can go out and enjoy some cocktails earlier, maybe see a movie together, see a play, and then come to Geha's and enjoy a lovely evening dinner and then go home, makes for a very nice night.
And that's exactly right, because I think that's one of the gripes. My youngest son lived in New York, and when I used to visit him out there, it was nice to go out, go to the play, go to the theater, and then be able to go out and enjoy a meal afterwards. Well, you really can't do that in a lot of places in Chicago.
Yeah.
But you can if you wanted to have and that's all you want is a little snack after you and a glass of wine.
Yes.
This is a perfect example and a perfect opportunity to do that.
Yes. And, that's why the late-night seating has sold out. I mean, we still have some tables at 10:30, but I expect they will be sold out this week, so...
55 years, Jeff, a long time. John Davis, many, many years ago, one of the first, if not the first person to start the wine clubs.
Yes, he started a Taste of California that developed into, he actually started in the garage of Geha's. There's garages behind Geha's. He started it there, and he had this wine club going for 30 years. He had 50,000 members.
Wow.
In his wine club between 38 states, where he was shipping two bottles of wine to every month. And then it was time for him to retire, and he sold the company. And the program is still going strong with another company.
Really?
So,
really?
Yeah.
Is John still alive?
As a matter of fact, at this moment, okay, John is just making his heart stronger. He's in the hospital getting a valve put in.
Okay, good.
And he just says, Jeff, I'm tweaking the parts. I'm being stronger. He's going to be 83 this year. He does Pilates 4 days a week.
Yeah.
And he still skis a little bit. He hikes a lot. He's a man on the go.
You're talking to a guy who had his hip replaced, and I'll tell you what, I got to do the yoga and the Pilates and exercise a whole different way than I did when I was an athlete, and I wish I would have started it earlier, and maybe I wouldn't have been in the shape I am.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, that's what John says. He's been doing it for 10 years.
Yeah.
And he says, Jeff, I don't wake up with any pain or any soreness, any aches.
Yeah, that's the truth. That's the truth.
Yeah.
Well, you won't have any aches if you spend a little time over at Geha's in a week or so. Tell us what the special things you got planned.
Well, like you have already said, we decorate on the 9th. I have a team of about 15 people coming in to transition our dining room into a palace of a restaurant of just red velvet curtains and lights and hanging little trinkets to make the dining room sparkle Valentine's. Then Monday is the celebration of marriage. And we have, our books are filling up. People are coming in early to celebrate Valentine's here. And we have the packages on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And we still have some room to make reservations there. Just go right to our website at gayhousecafe.com. And then we extended it into Monday because it is a holiday and mm-hmm. people will come in for that.
Good, good, good.
Yeah.
And the wines, of course, your selection of wines are always par excellence, second to none. Tell us some of the wines that you are going to be serving.
Well, we are in the middle of a champagne festival. It's our 40th annual champagne festival at Geha's, where we're featuring Laurent Perrier champagne.
Oh, my favorite. My favorite.
Lovely champagne.
My favorite.
And So we have about six of those by the glass and eight of those by the bottle. We have the rosé champagnes and sparklings. We'll have, as you mentioned, the flowers from Dilly Lily. Anybody can go right to our website and order that special touch for your table during Valentine's week. And if you really want to take it to the next level, is a couples massage at Dilly Lily.
Nice.
Go get a couples massage at Dilly Lily. It's for 1 hour. It's $88. It's the best deal in town. Great place right here in Lincoln Park. And then come just melt away in a booth at Geha's while you enjoy the melted cheese and the entree and the chocolate.
So. Do you see in the wine world that people are drinking more rosés now over the last couple of years?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. I would say it was 3 years ago, it was quite the rage mm-hmm. where, a lot of people, that's what they drank was rosés, and rosés at lunch, and rosés in the summer, and rosés on the patio, and rosé all day was the saying.
You know, so, I remember years ago when we first started drinking, Matus Rosé and Lancers, remember those from Portugal?
Oh, I mean, I was younger. I was.
We both are younger, I know.
I grew up on my dad having Christmas parties and having Lancers, okay? And then you melt the candle in the bottle and it flows down.
Right.
But then Matus Rosé was my first rosé. I would go to college parties carrying a bottle of Matus Rosé. I wouldn't drink beer. I stood out a little bit, but that's okay.
Are they still made?
Oh, yes, they are. They are made.
Matus and Lancers are still made, huh?
Yes, they are still made.
Wow,
yep.
Geez.
Yeah, and then starting in March, we're going to have a Southern Hemisphere Wine Festival where we're featuring wines from New Zealand, Australia, South America, Chile, and that's going to be quite a festival for 3 months where we will have a winemaker dinner, one in March, one in April, and one in May from these different countries. So we're going to have a lot of fun in the second quarter with our wine program here.
I would imagine you can count on one hand how many restaurants have been open as long as Geha's has successfully people enjoying your hospitality. 55 years.
It's a pretty distinguished list. And one thing I get a big charge out of is our liquor license number with the city of Chicago is number 41.
Really? Oh, okay.
Yes. Out of all the liquor licenses in Chicago, we're number 41.
And Berghoff's is number one.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Berghoff is up there. Village is up there. Italian Village.
Yeah. Yep. And the only reason, not only because of the ambiance, is because of you and your staff and the people who are so welcoming. You know, you can have great food and so forth. We have the best food in Chicago. But if you have people who aren't welcoming to the guests, who people don't want to come and gravitate towards, it's not going to be successful. And I think that's over the years what you've shown. That's what makes Geha's so impeccable.
I've been in the business since I was the age of 17. At 21, I said, this is what I want to do the rest of my life, because my heart would swell at creating wonderful experiences for guests. Okay, and I've carried that to this day and will always will, but the staff believe that too. They come here and they really want to give the guests, create for the guests a unique experience that you just don't have anywhere else, and it comes from their heart. We are so blessed here with the staff here. We have two staff members. One's been here 38 years and one's been here 40 years.
Wow.
This year. Wow. Isn't that crazy?
That's phenomenal.
That's wonderful.
That's phenomenal, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I can still hear that excitement in your voice, and thank you for that, and I thank you for all the patrons that have been there. And now that you are totally responsible for the restaurant, you have a different perspective of it. And I think that to wear all the hats, which you do, you know, you got to pay the bills, you got to make sure that everything is done right and it all falls on your shoulders. But still, to maintain that excitement, that passion that you have for it, I think that's very special. How do you enjoy in your new role as the owner of Geha's?
It's been a dream come true to have the opportunity to own Gehaz and carry it forward. My intention is to hopefully take it to its 75th anniversary, and then hopefully someone else will take it from here to 100 years. But with this new role, with these new hats, it's challenging. I enjoy it. It's a new way of having a relationship with the restaurants. But the true moments of joy are greeting the guests at the door, walking through the dining room, and seeing the guests have a wonderful time. That's where I get the moments of greatest joy. Yes, I look at the bank account every day. I pay the bills. Okay, I deal with all the headaches. Sometimes I clean the toilets. But you got to look for the gold. And there's gold in everything, but there's true gold in a smiling couple having a great time.
Well said, my friend. Well said. And nice souls having your new partner and your bride with you now. I think it's a whole different approach that you have to take to things.
Well, my lovely bride is resting in Honolulu as we speak. She's out there with a girlfriend. And, yes, I mean, so.
Well, it must be going okay then.
So I should get Husband of the Year award here. I mean.
Well, I hope she's going to be back for Valentine's Day.
Oh, she will be. She comes back about that, yes.
You know, we've been doing it for so long, and it's always a joy to chat with you. And I wish you all the success in the world and anything we can do to make people aware of the great job that you're doing. You know, we're always here for you. Known for romantic fondue dining, Food One prepares and shares, and an extensive list of fine, moderately priced wines. Gehaz Cafe features over 20 different types of fondue entrees, including cheese fondue and chocolate dessert fondue. An enchanting wine cellar atmosphere, private booths, and subdued lighting contribute to its intimate surroundings. Live flamenco and classical guitars provide romantic accompaniment. Be mine, Valentine. Gehaz Cafe, the renowned restaurant of romance, located at 340 West Armitage, is planning the most romantic Valentine celebration in its 55-year history. From Sunday, February 9th through Monday, February 17th, Gehaz Cafe will be elegantly decorated for the love-filled holiday and will feature a selection of rosé sparkling wines and champagnes, delicious fondue cuisine, perfectly complemented with entertainment throughout the evening from live flamenco and classical guitars. The Valentine's Festival also play host to the ever-popular Celebration of Marriage Night, where couples receive an added discount based on the years they have been married. And on the line with us right now is our dear friend, Jeff Lawler. Jeff, as I said, it's always a pleasure. Maybe a website or phone number if people like to get some information.
Yes, I mean, they can go right to our website at Gehaz Cafe. That's GEJASCafe.com. And right to our events page has everything that is going on this Valentine's celebration. And our phone number is 773-281-9101.
Always a pleasure, my dear friend. Happy Valentine's Day, and the best as always.
Happy Valentine's to you, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you, my pal.
Bye-bye.
Jeff Lawler, the owner and proprietor of Gehaz Cafe. Always the greatest celebration for Valentine's Day for 9 days, Sunday, February 9th through Monday, February 17th. You don't want to miss it. You'll be able to fit it in sometime, but if you can, always get down there. Jeff is one of our dear friends and certainly has been doing great things for so many years at Gehaz. For information, 773-281-9101. Well, since we're celebrating it, let's talk about the history of St. Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day started in the time of the Roman Empire. In ancient Rome, February 14th was a holiday to honor Juno. Juno was the queen of the Roman gods and goddesses. The Romans also knew her as the goddess of women and marriage. The lives of young boys and girls were strictly separate. However, one of the customs of the young people was name drawing. On the eve of the festival of Lupercalia, the names of Roman girls were written on slips of paper and placed into jars. Each young man would draw a girl's name from the jar and would then be partners for the duration of the festival with the girl whom he chose. Sometimes, the pairing of the children lasted an entire year, and often, they would fall in love and would later marry. Under the rule of Emperor Claudius II, Rome was involved in many bloody and unpopular campaigns. Claudius the Cruel was having a difficult time getting soldiers to join his military leagues. He believed that the reason was that Roman men did not want to leave their loves or families, and as a result, Claudius canceled all marriages and engagements in Rome. The good Saint Valentine was a priest at Rome in the days of Claudius II. He aided the Christian martyrs and secretly married couples, and for this kind deed, Saint Valentine was apprehended and dragged before the prefect of Rome, who condemned him to be beaten to death with clubs and to have his head cut off. He suffered martyrdom on the 14th day of February, 269 AD, the same day that had been devoted to love lotteries. Legend also says that St. Valentine left the farewell note for the jailer's daughter, who had become his friend, and signed it, "From your Valentine." Gradually, February 14th became the date for exchanging love messages, and St. Valentine became the patron saint of lovers. The date was marked by sending poems and simple gifts such as flowers. There was often a social gathering or a ball. Americans began to exchange handmade valentines in the early 1700s. The first mass-produced valentines in the United States were made around 1835 by a Mount Holyoke College student named Esther Howland. Her father, who owned a stationery store, imported valentines from England, but she wanted something more personal. She imported fancy paper and lace and employed assistants to help her enterprise. We currently celebrate Valentine's Day by honoring those we love with gifts, sentimental verses, and Valentine greeting cards. So, that's a little bit of the history of St. Valentine's Day. And let's enjoy Henry Mancini again, Charade, and we'll be back on the Kevin Moore Show.
Thank you.
from the great movie Charade, starring Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, music by Henry Mancini. And we're back on The Kevin Moore Show. Over the next couple weeks, we're all going to have the opportunity to see one of the great iconic works of opera, Madame Butterfly, at the Lyric Opera. What a great presentation. Cho-Cho-San, a captivating geisha in Nagasaki, marries Benjamin Franklin Pinkerton, an American naval lieutenant. For him, it's a lark, a diversion before he marries a real American wife. For her, it's a life-altering commitment that's briefly blissful, then disastrous. Her family renounces her, and Pinkerton leaves Japan. When he returns a few years later, her joy evaporates and catastrophe ensues when his true intentions are revealed. It is a wonderful first opera experience, Madame. Madama Butterfly epitomizes the best of this multifaceted art form, beautifully incorporating romantic tragedy with sublime musical storytelling, and is one of Puccini's greatest hits. For definition, a dramaturge is a professional within a theater or opera company who deals mainly with research and development of plays or operas, explaining their various types, their interconnectedness, and their styles. A dramaturge provides historical and cultural research into the play or opera and its setting. And if any of our listeners are so inclined to visit our website, www.kevinmoorepresents.com, you'll see that we've been very fortunate to have some very interesting, talented, and accomplished guests from the worlds of entertainment, music, film, the literary arts, the world of food and wine, and a myriad of other pursuits. And it has been both a pleasure and an honor to chat with them and make their acquaintance. But my guest, with whom I will be soon speaking, has always been a special joy. He is an erudite, scholarly, well-spoken, and thoroughly informational gentleman of the classical and contemporary arts, and I so much enjoy the lively and engaging conversations we share. So if I may, on the line with us right now is the award-winning staff member of the Lyric Opera of Chicago, where he has invaluably served as a dramaturge since 1995. Commentator for the opera broadcasts, program editor, special lecturer, and the writer of the projected supertitles we view at the opera. Roger has worked with the San Diego Opera and the Dallas Opera and has contributed many articles to both American and European publications and has served for many years on the Metropolitan Opera's Opera Quiz. And now the opera is presenting Giacomo Puccini's Madame Butterfly through March 8th at the Lyric Opera. 20 North Wacker on the line with us right now is Roger Pines. Roger, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Hi, Kevin. It's so nice to speak with you again.
Always a pleasure. And, you know, Roger, this has got to be my favorite, I think. Next to Turandot, I think this is my favorite.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Well, we'll look forward to welcoming you to a performance. And actually, you should come twice because we have two different butterflies and two different Pinkertons.
Okay,
so it would
okay.
be great if you could hear both pairs of singers.
Well, it's all enjoyable and certainly one of Puccini's, I think, this is Puccini's, as he says, his favorite opera?
I don't think he really had a particular favorite, but he adored her. He adored his heroine. I mean, he always fell in love with his heroines anyway, mm-hmm. but he was extremely devoted to the character of Butterfly, and he gave her really everything he had, and that's why he was so devastated when the opera opened at La Scala in Milan. It failed. It failed at its premiere, and fortunately, he cared so deeply about it that he revised it, and in a couple of months, it opened again, and then it was successful, and it's been one of the most popular operas in the repertoire for, you know, well over a century, and audiences, I don't think, can get enough of it. It's a, you know, I talk about magic titles sometimes,
and
there are very few of those left in the operatic repertoire. But Butterfly is one, and people just adore it because of their own emotional involvement in the experience. You cannot go to a performance of Butterfly and not be profoundly moved by it, especially in the kind of production that we have with the kinds of singers that we have. I mean, they're brilliant.
And the Lyric has produced this, what, 16 times?
That sounds like the right number. You know, we've had it on our stage since our second year in existence. Really? The Lyric opened in 54, and then 55 with Maria Callas. I mean, we presented Butterfly, and she's, you know, this opera's kept coming back.
Her final appearance at the Lyric at the time.
It was. You know that whole story, yes, in 1955. But we were very privileged here that she did the role here because she never did it anywhere else. Her three performances of the role all happened on our stage.
Oh, she never did this anywhere else, huh? That's interesting.
No, she recorded it. She recorded it, but she never did it again on stage.
Well, let's tell the story about Cho-Cho-San and Benjamin Franklin Pinkerton.
Right. Yeah. You were right before when you said that he sort of views this as a lark, as something fun to do when he's in Nagasaki. But so he does marry her, and she's a geisha, and she makes an extraordinary sacrifice. She renounces her religion for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so she makes that commitment, and as a result, when her family finds out about it, when her uncle, the priest, reveals it in front of everybody that she's done this, she's completely rejected by her family. So she has no one except him and her devoted maid/companion, Suzuki.
Mm-hmm.
But then he goes back to America, and he says to her, "I'll come back when the robins are nesting," but 3 years go by.
Mm-hmm.
And she just waits and waits for him because she's completely convinced that he loves her and that he's coming back. And what he doesn't know is that he left her with child. So she waits for him. And, you know, a very great American soprano, Martina Arroyo, who was a well-known butterfly, she said once, she talked about the honesty of presenting on stage a character who is in love with a man and believes he's going to come back to her when everybody else around her knows that he isn't going to.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's it in a nutshell.
Right,
that's what
right.
makes this so devastating. Because he does come back because he is informed by the American consul, his friend Sharpless. He's informed that he has a child by Butterfly, and he comes back. But he brings his American wife with him, and he comes back to take the child.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it for her. She takes her life in hand, and what she decides to do is to kill herself with the dagger with which her own father had committed suicide years before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty intense stuff, but the music is glorious. And the opportunities for a truly great singing actress in this role are glorious, too.
Is this what most sopranos aspire to?
A lot of them do, actually, especially if they have this innate feeling for Puccini's style. You need to really be able to communicate emotionally without going overboard, with still being faithful to what Puccini's given you musically. But if you're really committed, a committed theatrical performer, and you have the right kind of voice for it, then yes, I think people do dream about it, especially if a soprano is a mother herself.
Mm-hmm.
That really can create something very special in the relationship that that the soprano has on stage with the child actor portraying Butterfly's child, whose name is actually Sorrow, Dolore. I've always been fascinated to watch how the interaction on stage between the soprano and the child. And I remember one of our previous Butterflies was doing an interview with me, and she talked about the challenges of performing on stage with a child and what she is as an artist, as a sensitive artist, had to do to create a trust that the child would have in her. That can be a very beautiful element of any Butterfly production, is this relationship between Butterfly and her child. And also between Butterfly and the character of Suzuki. There needs to be a real emotional connection there. Suzuki is really sort of the rock of in the only true support that Butterfly has in her life. So I love also watching their interaction and listening to them, because they have this exquisite duet. When Butterfly sights Pinkerton's ship coming into the harbor, and she's ecstatic, she knows he's coming back to her, and she and Suzuki decorate the house with flowers. They scatter blossoms all over, and while doing that, they sing this really, really ravishing duet, and the interplay of voices, and the match of one vocal timbre to the other is always very rewarding for me, sitting there as an audience member listening.
Je ti amo, Amani Piana.
Sorry?
Isn't that the song, Je ti amo?
That you may be thinking of the love duet of the tenor and the soprano, but that's not actually part of the flower duet. But there's some very super affectionate, loving language that, of course, we get in the duet between Pinkerton and Butterfly. And it's important to state that at that moment, he does love her. He loves her for that little fleeting moment at the end of Act One, where they sing this duet, and the music is such that it makes it so difficult to accept Pinkerton's rejection of her, because, you know, anybody who could sing that way to his bride, you just assume that it's all going to be okay, and it's not. It's not. He turns out to be a real cad. A real heel. It's really too
You know,
bad.
You talk about Delorte, the child sorrow.
Yeah. I
was watching, I think it was an American Experience. It was, whether it was the Met, but the child was played by a puppet, which was a different.
Yeah.
Different. It was a very different perspective.
It really, you know, I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it when the Met did it, the HD transmission to movie theaters. So I was watching the puppet up close on a movie mm-hmm. screen. But I was actually quite convinced by it, and I surprised myself, because I thought, oh, my gosh, to not have a human being in this role, to have a mechanical object. But the way the puppet was manipulated was really brilliant.
Yeah.
And so I thought, this is a really interesting alternative, which is not saying that I prefer the puppet, because I don't. I do want to see an actual child on the stage.
You see so many different emotions in the opera, the initial happiness at the wedding where Butterfly embraces Christianity and changes from Buddhism and so forth.
That's already happened, actually, when she comes on stage. She talks about it, but we know that we don't hear that the family doesn't hear that it's happened until this priest, who is Butterfly's uncle, comes mm-hmm. on stage and is very thunderous, and as he announces this to everybody, and oh my gosh, they instantly turn against her. It's a really powerful moment. My favorite moment of the whole show, I have to say, is the moment when she sights the ship, and mm-hmm. what she says, and it's a wonderful brief passage where she's talking about how everybody around her was scornful and they were in despair for her. And she says, it's my triumph now because he's returned and he loves me. A torna, a mama. And she takes that up to a high B-flat, which she holds. And she does it in such a way. It's an arpeggio, and what Puccini was doing is in that passage is that he was paying tribute to the American national anthem. That phrase where she says "E torna e mamma," it sounds just like "Oh say can you see?"
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and so she has it really reiterates her commitment to him, an American. But at the same time, it is her triumph for at that moment. He has returned, and there's been so much tension that's been building up to this point that it becomes that declaration, he's returned and he loves me, becomes this moment of emotional relief that the audience, I think, is quite desperate for. And often when she takes that high B flat, the audience bursts into applause because all this tension has been you know, pent up inside them. And that moment musically just sort of almost cries out for that release that you feel. And that moment leads directly into this wonderful flower duet for the soprano and the mezzo-soprano. He was so canny in the way he structured things musically and theatrically. He was such a man of the theater, and he knew what spoke to audiences. And so he plays on their emotions in such a powerful way. And it leaves you, that moment leaves you in with such complete admiration for the soprano playing Butterfly, because she is on stage. Once she comes on, at her entrance in Act One, she is absent from the stage only for about 5 minutes for the rest of the opera. And it's such a test of her stamina as a vocalist and of her energy as an actress. So with both of our sopranos, Ana Maria Martinez and Liana Harutunian, I mean, I'm really in awe that they can have so much success all over the world in this really exceptionally challenging role.
And the relationships are so very interesting. The relationship, as you mentioned, between Suzuki, her servant, and Chocho-san, who she respects, she loves. The relationship between Sharpless and Chocho-san, he doesn't want to divulge what really is happening from that letter that he receives. The relationship
That's
between
right.
Sharpless and Pinkerton, a different relationship.
The Sharpless is really crucial. We have a wonderful artist singing the role, Anthony Clark Evans, who has the kind of warmth in the voice that you absolutely need, and the concern for Butterfly, and also has the strength to say to Pinkerton, you know, this is terrible. What's happened? Mm-hmm. I always am eager to see. In Act One, that scene between Pinkerton and Sharpless, because that's where that character initially asserts himself. And he's wise enough to say to Pinkerton, this is hugely important, to say to him, you know, you're taking this very lightly, but you got to think about her. It may be, you know, so important to her. She may be sort of, you know, staking everything on this. You got to think about that. Mm-hmm. And Pinkerton, of course, blows that off.
Sure.
And he says, let's drink a toast to the real American wife that I will one day marry. Mm-hmm. So, oh my, Pinkerton, it infuriates me more than just about any tenor character in opera. But it'll be very interesting to see our two tenors, Brian Jade and Brandon Jovanovich, because they are such romantic presences on the stage. They will make Pinkerton, they will give him as much appeal as is possible to do, I think.
And, of course, the tragic ending, death with honor is better than life with dishonor.
That's
and,
right. That's right.
We all cry at the end.
Oh, I was just listening in my office on the speaker the other day during the dress rehearsal, and when she saw the ship and sang out E Torna E Mama, I was sobbing. Oh, my goodness. So
Madam
I'm going to be there tomorrow for the opening night. Yeah.
Madam Butterfly, Chow Chow San, a captivating geisha in Nagasaki, marries Benjamin Franklin Pinkerton, an American naval lieutenant. For him, it's a lark, a diversion before he marries, as Roger says, a real American wife. For her, it's a life-altering commitment that's briefly blissful, then disastrous. Her family renounces her, and Pinkerton leaves Japan when he returns a few years later. Her joy evaporates, and catastrophe ensues when his true intentions are revealed. It is a wonderful first opera experience, and it is one of Puccini's greatest hits. And on the line with us right now is the dramaturge from Lyric Opera, who we always enjoy chatting with, Roger Pines. Roger, always a pleasure to chat, always a pleasure to get some different insight into any operas that we talk about. And I hope we can keep this relationship going, because it's something that's very engaging and culturally stimulating that we have these conversations.
Thank you ever so much. I really appreciate this, and I'll look forward to the next time.
I'm looking forward to seeing it in a couple weeks, and
great.
We'll all enjoy it and go through the tragedy of Chocho-san and Pinkerton again.
Right.
Thank you, my pal.
Thank you.
Take care, Roger. Roger Pines, the dramaturge, very talented dramaturge from Lyric Opera, now presenting Puccini's Madame Butterfly through March 8th. The Lyric Opera, for information, 312-827-5600. Puccini's great operas, Manon Lescaut, La Boheme, Tosca, Madame Butterfly, Turandot, one of my favorites also. An opportunity for, as I said in the introduction, for somebody who hasn't seen the opera yet to go to Lyric and enjoy it. And a way to do that, and I've said this before on the show, read a little bit of the, and I hope we touched upon it as Roger was giving a great synopsis of the opera and the characters. Read a little bit about it. Read the story behind it so you know the story. And when you go into the opera, you'll be able to enjoy the ambiance and the emotional feeling of being there. You won't understand necessarily the Italian in which it's sung, but there are super titles, which Roger is responsible for, that you'll be able to read and hear what they're singing about. And they repeat their lines more than once, so you'll hear them more than once. But to see the atmosphere and the sets and just this great masterpiece that was premiered in 1904, came to the New York Metropolitan Opera in 1907, and finally to the Lyric in 1955, and has been presented so many times since. Something that you can say you can be a part of, and so I would again recommend it highly. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guest, our good pal Jeff Lawler, the award-winning leader in the hospitality industry and his restaurant of romance, Geja's Cafe, celebrating Valentine's Day, 340 West Armitage, for 9 days, beginning Sunday, February 9th through Monday, February 17th. For information, 773-281-9101. And Roger Pines, the award-winning dramaturge of the Lyric Opera, now presenting Giacomo Puccini's Madame Butterfly, Madama Butterfly, through March 8th at the Lyric Opera, 20 North Wacker. For information, 312-827-5600. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought every day at least to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have, at the very least, done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week, and as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone.
Time you hear her name, I know the way I feel for you. It's now or never. The more I love, the more that I'm afraid. But in your eyes, I may not see forever. Forever. If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, then a luck, then I suppose the music, the music.